time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Gregory Button. Dr. Gregory Button is a nationally recognized expert on disasters who has been studying extreme events for over 30 years. As a reporter and producer for public radio, he covered and reported on the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the controversy surrounding Love Canal, and the eruption of Mount St. Helens. He has also been a U.S. Congressional Fellow in the Senate. He is currently a faculty member in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and co-director of the Center for the Study of Social Justice. And he is here to talk about his new book, Disaster Culture, Knowledge and Uncertainty in the Wake of Human and Environmental Catastrophe. Greg, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, Disaster Culture?
Well, I conducted research over the last 3.5 decades on disasters and catastrophes in general, and I've noticed in the last decade alone an increasing trend that in the wake of these disasters, some of the information that ensues can be quite confusing and conflicting to individuals. And it's not unnormal at all to have uncertainty in the wake of disasters. In fact, it's quite common. But the disturbing thing that I've discovered in recent times is that there's this intentional production of uncertainty that's often generated by corporations or government agencies or sometimes by NGOs in order to create the kind of level of uncertainty that might allow different people from facing litigious outcomes or agencies being scrutinized by other agencies or congressional committees. And one of the many troubling things about this is that in the wake of a disaster, in the immediate days and hours after a disaster, we need to know as much as we can accurately about the nature of the event, the cause of the event, and some of the issues surrounding it. And it becomes much difficult to respond in real time effectively to an event if it's clouded by uncertainty, particularly kind of uncertainty that's generated by the various parties that I mentioned. There is often a lot of scientific uncertainty, of course, especially in disasters which are technological in nature. Of course, the most recent examples might be the BP oil spill in the Gulf, which occurred just about a year ago, and certainly the recent crisis in Japan, nuclear crisis in Japan. And in the wake of a disaster like that, it's common for both the media and politicians and the general public to turn to scientists for answers. And the media demands instant answers in order to meet their daily deadlines. And the private individuals, particularly those who are affected by the disaster, crave answers in order to make decisions about their personal life and assess the kinds of risks and hazards they might face. But unfortunately, science to a large degree, because of its rigorous methodological approach, is often slow and unable to meet those demands, much to the disappointment of many. And that creates an opportunity for corporations or other people to actually generate more uncertainty or downplay the actual effect of the disaster. And of course, it's not uncommon for governments to do that as well. I mean, I think a perfect example of that among many recent catastrophes is the nuclear crisis in Japan, in which it's been obvious to many onlookers in both international in the international domain that the Japanese government has from day one downplayed the actual seriousness of the event and has not been as forthcoming about what's going on there as many of us would like. So noticing this trend, I decided to look at it in depth because I think that it does prevent effective response. And I think also that people who are adversely affected by disasters have a right to know as much information as they can in order to decide whether or not to evacuate or to, you know, relocate or do many other things they might do in order to protect themselves, their families, and their communities. So that was the primary motivation for the book itself.
And you also teach in the same field about disasters.
Yes, that's right. For the last 25 years, most of the courses I've taught are on disasters, catastrophe, environmental health issues pertaining to that. In many ways, it's primarily my major research focus, and it's been, you know, just become since my early days as a reporter my primary area of interest.
When you were a reporter and covering this, what attracted you to?
Well, when I was a senior in college, the Santa Barbara oil spill occurred. And that's an interesting precursor to the BP spill or even the Exxon Valdez spill. And for my honors thesis, I wrote a paper on the Santa Barbara oil spill. It was the first offshore deep well drilling disaster in U.S. waters. And when I graduated from college with several majors, I at first didn't know what I wanted to do, but decided for a while I wanted to be a journalist. And as a journalist, I began simply, I think almost by accident to begin with, to cover disasters, catastrophes, and environmental health issues. And over time, that became officially and unofficially my beat, something by which I was known in the journalism community. I did that for several years until I realized that I really became something of an expert, but I never had enough time to be the expert I would like to be because of the need to meet daily deadlines and the hectic life of being a journalist. So I finally decided to go back to graduate school and actually study disasters in depth to become more of an expert, if you will. And it just so happened that when I finished my graduate studies, the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened, and I was fortunate enough to get funding and opportunity to go to Alaska, and I spent a long time there researching that disaster. And in fact, over the last 20 years, I've returned many times. And since then, I've covered a lot of disasters, 1993 Mississippi floods, Hurricane Katrina, the BP spill, currently now the nuclear crisis in Japan, and many other events along the way. And the advantage of that, to some degree, is you begin to detect certain underlying patterns. So while there are specific differences between one event and another, and we need to heed those, at the same time, there are certain common denominators. Along that lines, I just like to make one cautionary comment, and that is I think the general public and the media itself often like to compare disasters to one another, and their expectation is one will meet the other. So now, in the wake of the crisis in Japan, a lot of people are saying, is it or is it not, like Chernobyl? And I think that misses the point. It's its own disaster, and it's never going to be the same kind of event for a variety of historical and scientific reasons as one of another. You find that, too, in the wake, even with disasters that are like one another. For instance, in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill, which captured the world's attention, a few years later there was an even larger spill in the Shetland Islands, and a tank went ashore there and caused a tremendous amount of damage. And the international media, of course, immediately responded, and their expectation was that given that it was a 62 degrees north latitude and it was a large oil spill and it was a salmon fishing community, that it would play out like the Exxon Valdez would, and it would resemble it in many ways. And in fact, it didn't, because it was a unique spill unto itself. And many of the reporters there eventually went home rather prematurely, I think, because their editors and producers said, this isn't the Exxon. You know, this isn't the spectacle we thought it would be. And because it doesn't resemble that prior pattern, we're going to move on. But it was actually essentially a mistake, because in and of itself, it was a tremendous event, and it had great impact on the environment and on people and public health. And it was a unique story, but it was overlooked because it didn't meet the public and the media's expectation. And that's a very common kind of attitude that we have now in the general public.
So creating this, talk a bit more about creating uncertainty. You mentioned that the three different players, the government, corporations, and NGOs, each want to create uncertainty. It seems, for instance, in the example of the BP oil spill, that they weren't doing that necessarily independently. It seemed that they were doing that in concert together.
Who's the together?
Well, let's say the government pretty much turned things over to BP and then didn't seem overly questioning.
Well, absolutely. Let's back up a little. That's an excellent question. Speaking of lessons learned in the wake of disasters, there have been many, and unfortunately, often they're not applied, much to the chagrin of researchers like myself and emergency response managers. And one of the major ones, if not, in fact, the major one in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill was never. And they said this emphatically in the Presidential Commission report and in the State of Alaska final report on the spill itself. Never put a polluter in charge of the cleanup of a spill for a variety of reasons. It was a really faithfully wrong decision. The spill should have been cleaned up, been federalized under federal law, and the Exxon should not have played such a central role. So here we are several, a couple of decades later, we have another huge oil spill in U.S. waters. And the Obama administration places BP in charge of the cleanup effort. And in fact, under new national disaster response plans, they also make them a, quote, partner in the spill cleanup. Well, one of the things, one of the many troubling aspects about that, among many, is the fact that to a large degree, BP had access to a lot of the data in terms of the size and the flow of the spill and potential harm, perhaps, of dispersants, et cetera, than anyone else, including some government agencies. And the government, to some degree, because they saw them as a partner, relied on them, I think, probably too much. There wasn't enough of a firewall between them and the federal government. So you did actually get that kind of partnership where while some agencies in the government and certainly the executive branch itself played down the disaster in many ways, in many troubling ways, as of course did the BP, which one would expect because there's a huge conflict of interest there and they stand to lose a considerable amount of money in litigation. But one of the other things that happened is that it became a far more troubling situation than the Exxon spill in that many independent researchers in the hard sciences and the social sciences, along with the media, were unable to gain access to Ground Zero in a variety of ways, as well as data. First and foremost, they weren't allowed to fly below 3,000 feet. Therefore, they couldn't really see the size and flow of the oil spill very well. The independent researchers, many of them, some of the most prestigious and well-known researchers in various fields that would apply to oil spills, couldn't gain the information and data from either BP or the federal government, couldn't gain access to it. Social scientists like myself had similar troubling problems in gaining access. And, of course, eventually the media had problems. The media was very restricted eventually from gaining access to Ground Zero. The Coast Guard would deny it was their fault. BP would deny it was their fault. But many agencies, including major news networks and magazines and PBS itself, Frontline, et cetera, were thwarted in gaining access to Ground Zero under a variety of regulations, including ironic ones in the fact that in some areas in early days, reporters were not allowed to go on certain heavily oiled beaches on the outer shore, whereas tourists were, which is ludicrous in and of itself. But also they came up with rules and regulations where photojournalists, even using the largest possible telescopic lenses they could use, were not able to get close enough to actually photograph the oiled birds or the oil on the beaches or on the water because of a distance limit that was set by the Coast Guard. There were great difficulties in gaining information about the medical health of the cleanup workers and the people exposed to both the dispersants and the oil spills. The troubling thing about that was the primary clinic that was monitoring that was actually operated by BP. It should have been operated by the federal government or the state government, and they had contracted that out to a private contractor. So when journalists and people in the public health and the medical domain tried to gain access to that clinic, not to the records of the people themselves, not to invade their privacy, but to get a sense of the possible scope of harm that might have been inflicted on the cleanup workers, the media was denied access and entry, regardless of whether they were Time Magazine or NPR, or et cetera, et cetera. But so were many prominent medical researchers whose field it was to look actually at the health of cleanup workers and occupational health and safety issues. So the BP became a gatekeeper, and that rose some troubling questions about conflict of interest, particularly because obviously it wouldn't have been in BP's interest for any information to have been revealed that, in fact, people were perhaps suffering adverse effects to their exposure, and to the fact that that should be public information. So there were a lot of troubling things like that, many of your listeners may recall, that occurred. One of the problems with that is that I've noticed as a researcher in the last decade alone that this is an increasing trend for social scientists, media people, former media people like myself and hard scientists. In the wake of these catastrophes within the United States, it's getting increasingly harder to gain access to information, and transparency has been compromised severely. And while I'm used to that, and I think some other people are used to that, and working in undeveloped countries or other countries in the world, it's somewhat upsetting and startling to me that in a democracy and in a country which prizes freedom of access to information, that this trend has increased. And that's, again, one of the motivations for writing the book.
So it sounds like BP has, and large corporations like that, have learned lessons from previous disasters.
Oh, absolutely. They learned them better than the government, unfortunately. They're very savvy about it, lessons learned and not learned. And, of course, they can make mistakes themselves. But, nevertheless, they're able to actually analyze that information and improve upon it. So sometimes they'll copy things that have worked in the past, like Exxon actually created kind of false media events where they supposedly were cleaning up heavily oiled beaches and the event only occurred for a day, and then the crews were sent home and the film crews and the national networks went back to New York or Washington and played a story, but in the interim, the crews were laid off, and it was all just an event that was created for that day. And that went on several times, but that also went on with the BP oil spill, where these kinds of fake spectacles, cleanup efforts were created because the president or someone from the administration might be visiting for a day, and, they had these would-be cleanup efforts that were only media events and not really earnest cleanup efforts. So sometimes they repeat that, but they've learned a lot from it. And unfortunately, government agencies, regulatory bodies, have not learned as much and also have been in many ways complicit. I mean, sometimes it's in the government's interest, as you've pointed out, for them to actually work in concert with someone like the BP, because government agencies are very sensitive to outside scrutiny. And in this case, of course, it was Department of Interior and MMS, the Mineral Management Services within Department of Interior, who had been so captured and taken over and corrupted by the oil industry that they were very leery of people both within other government agencies and the general public from learning about that level of corruption. Unfortunately, that eventually came out in the news, but it was a difficult story to tell at first because of lack of access.
So do you see that as a potential problem with what is currently happening with the nuclear part disaster in Japan, with TEPCO being in charge of cleaning up and dealing with their own facilities?
Well, absolutely. I think that at a certain point, I mean, obviously now the Japanese government itself has pointed the finger at TEPCO, and I think TEPCO has, of course, pointed the finger back at the Japanese government. But I think both are guilty of withholding information and being very vague about the kind of information they released to the general public, who obviously need to know and a right to know, but also to the international community. And I think at first the international community and some of the media at first trusted and relied upon the information they were being given, perhaps too much. But it became obvious that the situation was far worse than it was being depicted, and they were downplaying it in various ways. And now even in the international domain, particularly among people who work in the nuclear industry, they're somewhat disheartened by the fact that that they haven't been forthcoming. On the other hand, the media has, to a large degree, basically repeated the kind of, I would say, PR propaganda that the international nuclear community would like to have promoted. That is, that it's safe, and even if we exceed threshold levels, it's safe, et cetera, et cetera. They often quote people who are associated with the nuclear power plant industry as downplaying it as being sources of authority. But, you know, in the public health community, in the medical community, we have a very different attitude toward that, and that is that these threshold levels that the industry has created during the Cold War era to promote nuclear power in general, it's erroneous. It's spurious that, you know, exposure to carcinogens and toxins, even low-level ones like radioactive iodine, which have a short life, or certainly higher ones like cesium-137 that has an afterlife of 30 years, that, it's too glib and easy to say that there's a safe threshold. In reality, there isn't a safe threshold, and it varies from community to community, from the vulnerability of one particular individual to another, but there's a huge disparity between that and what the nuclear industry is saying. And the media has tended in many quarters, at least in the mainstream media, to quote the reinsurances that have been given by the nuclear power industry and by the U.S. government, because the U.S. government, of course, is working hand-in-hand with the nuclear power industry and has been very involved in it since the Cold War. And so you only find in certain progressive news outlets or in certain remote interviews, you find people actually saying the opposite or saying what we call the counter-narrative, saying, no, that's not necessarily a safe level, and we don't necessarily feel that we're out of harm's way. I mean, I think the tendency is to say everything's safe, to reassure the public, and then there's the other tendency, which can also be dangerous, and that is prematurely, without having enough information, to predict that there'll be an apocalypse of some kind. And I think they're both wrong-headed. I mean, the problem really is if we had reliable information, we'd be better able to judge what is going to happen rather than kind of guess. And at this stage of the game, it's still a problem of it's difficult to know who to believe, you know, because of the conflicting information. But that's very typical of a technological disaster in modern times.
So about 10 minutes left. Talk about more about the lessons learned and what you see as solutions towards better dealing with disasters.
Well, there are some lessons learned, and I say they've been ignored. And I think at the onset, it's important to say that the one thing that we've learned, ironically, the U.S. government has sponsored a good deal of the research that occurred in the last 50 years, is that it's better to prevent disasters from happening than actually having to deal with remediating them or responding to them or having to work in a prolonged recovery period. And that is that there are many ways in which we can make communities less vulnerable, both the citizens, the infrastructures, and the environment. And we need to do those because, you know, to a large degree, once the genie's out of the bottle, it's out of the bottle, and it's very difficult to undo the harm, particularly in something like radiation leakage or an oil spill and many other instances. So, you know, the primary lesson that we talk about is let's be more preventative and let's think more long-term about the things we can do. But then when you think about responding to disasters if they happen, well, then the problem really is on several levels. One is that there's an increasing tendency to actually have a very highly centered command system, which is remote from ground zero, in which creates a very kind of authoritarian control system, often called the incident command system. And to some degree, that's troubled in many ways. It's troubled because it doesn't really respond to empirically what we know is best, and that is that it's better to keep as much as you can, the response level as close to the ground zero as possible and involve the community as much as possible, and to have more autonomy and resilience in being able to respond to it than a kind of a rigid command system. The irony is that there's a lot of international literature, robust literature that demonstrates we need to do something like that. And in many countries around the world, including even some undeveloped countries, but some of our partners in Europe, they've actually taken to the model of decentralizing response to disasters rather than relying on Homeland Security in D.C. or some remote location. And it's proved to be effective. But in the United States, we've been actually working in the opposite direction and ignoring the empirical literature and doing things that make it more difficult and awkward to respond effectively, particularly in the immediate hours and days that follow a disaster itself. Then there's one of the problems that we've learned and studied is that there's actually something we call disaster continuum. That is, on that continuum, the far end, you might look at a chronic disaster. That's one that isn't triggered by an event like a hurricane or tornado. It's very slow, erupts very slowly, comes to our attention perhaps a decade or two later. That might be toxic groundwater contamination or some other environmental hazard. And then there's the disaster that might occur like the onset of Hurricane Katrina, where at a given day, at a given time, a hurricane comes ashore. And then that's when the media pays attention, the public pays attention, and that's, of course, when the disaster response systems kick in. And we tend to pay attention in the immediate aftermath, depending on the nature and the extent of the disaster, for a short period of time. And then there's the recovery period. And the recovery period is often ignored by politicians and policymakers. But those of us who have been studying disasters realize that many disasters, particularly those of significant magnitude and severity, like Hurricane Katrina or the Exxon Valdez oil spill, needless to say, the recent BP spill, that period of time can last for many years, many decades. That is the ensuing harm that can occur. And rather than pay attention to that or try to remedy that, oftentimes policymakers, politicians, the media, they just move on to the next spectacle or the next sensational news. But what we've really found is that it's often difficult to gauge what the true harmful impact of a disaster is unless we study them in longitudinal terms. So, for instance, in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill, it was obvious at the initial onset that certain harm was done to the environment and to the human communities who were affected by it. But as we studied it over time, that is a long period of time, we noticed that there was some harm to the environment and human populations that we hadn't predicted or we didn't know. And we only knew that because of our long, protracted studies. And when you realize something like that, then you realize that you need a commitment on behalf of the public and by the politicians to make the long-term commitment to actually pay attention to that long-term harm and try to resolve it and undo that harm as opposed to just moving on and forgetting about it. In other words, we prematurely move on. But in reality, even in smaller disasters, that recovery period, which is in most people's minds only a few weeks or months, is actually often several years. And that's sometimes where even more harm that can be done than the original disaster itself. And we have documentation of that in certain disasters. So we think that's one of the major lessons not learned, and we're really worried that the government and the media tends to do that. I mean, if you think about the media coverage itself, the media moves on very quickly from one disaster to another. In fact, most recently with the nuclear crisis in Japan, while it was actually coming to a head and revelations were coming out about just how severe the actual event was and the potential for great harm, almost within that 24-hour news cycle period, the media switched its attentions to Libya. And while, you know, you might say it's because they felt maybe the public was tiring of the story in Japan, it might also be because war and conflict is more vivid and photogenic than the invisible threat of nuclear radiation. But for whatever reason, it is very typical of the media to do that. And, you know, one stark example of that is the earthquake in Haiti over a year ago now, which killed 350,000 people, devastated the country, destroyed the infrastructure, and is still a country that's in great despair and need of help in the international community and foundering, and people are suffering. But the media has basically forgotten that story, moved on, and so is then, of course, the general public. And actually, the severity of some of the consequences there might even match the severity of consequences from the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, perhaps, at least argumentatively. But we've forgotten about it. We're not paying attention to it. We move on. We have this kind of short attention span. And that's not helpful to us, because at some point we have to sit back and ask ourselves why it is that in recent years, and this has been documented by numerous scientists, we have not only had more disasters, both large and small, but the magnitude and severity of them is increasing. So we have to ask ourselves why. Is this just some blip in geologic time, or is it the way in which we're relating to our environment and the kind of things that we're doing? Because to a large degree, the impact and severity of disasters is not simply the event itself, but the way in which communities and social and political organizations we respond to them. And if we're not effective, then we can make them worse. Engineers have a saying that is applicable on some level, and they say, you know, earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do. So to a large degree, whether you're talking about infrastructure or social political response, the harm that can result in the wake of a catastrophe is not simply from the event of the event itself, but how we as a culture, as a nation, respond to these events. And I'm afraid we have not learned to respond to them very effectively. And with the onset of, you know, the potential for great harm with climate change, and just the very fact, as I mentioned, that we're having disasters of greater magnitude and severity, I mean, just look at what happened in the last year. So, Haiti, Chile, Japan, now the crisis and they're just unfolding. The floods in Pakistan, they were just kind of brushed over. I mean, that was a horrific catastrophe, but we paid less attention to it than we did Haiti, and yet it was probably equal in magnitude and severity on many levels. But we need to stop and reflect and look back as a culture and say, what's going on, and what can we do to not only prevent these things but respond to them more effectively?
And we only have just about a minute left. Do you think our perception and our response is unique to just the primary Western cultures, United States? And
no, I don't. I mean, I think to some degree what you have to keep in mind is the overall major response around the world is often generated by the United States and other major superpowers, because we have the money, the resources, the standing. But I think that in different cultures and different societies, you have a troubling resemblance. It varies greatly. It also depends on their capacity, their economic capacity, their government capacity. Obviously, Haiti was at a loss because they didn't have much governmental capacity. But I think that if you look at the events that have affected us here in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, yes, you can point a finger at our culture and our way of life, and perhaps our government's inability to respond effectively to a disaster. And that's troubling enough.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming
and
spending time with us
today.
Thanks for
having me, Mike. Appreciate it.
We've just been talking with Dr. Gregory Button. He is author of the new book, Disaster Culture, Knowledge and Uncertainty in the Wake of Human and Environmental Catastrophe.